Well, good afternoon, everyone. Well, we are almost ending the first Questio Facti workshop, and we are so pleased to announce that there will be a second edition co-organized by the Chair in Legal Culture and the Universidad de Lisboa, thanks to Professor Pablo de Sousa Mendes' willingness. So next year we are going to meet in Lisboa, the beautiful Lisboa. Well, thank you everyone to be here. The last talk, last but not least, is from Professor Renko Van Rijn. He is a professor of European Legal History and Comparative Civil Procedure at Maastricht University and director of the program Foundations and Principles of Civil Procedure in Europe of the US Communal Research School. Thank you, Professor, to be here, and it's your time for your talk.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. We enjoyed Girona very much already. Yesterday I had a chance to see the city. It's beautiful. You are hoping that this workshop has nearly finished, but that's not true, because this is going to be a very long presentation. So I want to prove something before I get started. I'm feeling a little bit ill, but I brought my tie. So the intentions were good. But I hope you will excuse me, because it's a bit unpleasant at the moment. You don't have a tie, no? So I'm in good company. I'm going to talk about evidence in civil litigation, so not on evidence in criminal law. And actually, that's according to the continental tradition. I know that traditionally in common law countries, evidence is a topic on its own. I was in South Africa, and there they had a book, and evidence in criminal procedure, that was treated in the same book as evidence in civil matters. But for us, on the continent, it's really something that is separate. And evidence law is not taught as a topic on its own, even not evidence law in civil cases, but it's part of courses on civil procedure. And obviously, you could say, that evidence law is the backbone of many of these courses, very important in courses on civil procedure. It has a very long history, most likely both on the European continent and in England and Wales. And if you're interested in the history of evidence law in the civil law tradition, there's a very nice book, and I'm actually referring to the same author as Ellen has done, professor from Zagreb, Mijan Damaška. He wrote a book on the history of evidence in criminal procedure, recently published. And it gives you a very nice overview and insights, new insights in how the area developed. And also, when you're not interested in criminal procedure, it's a useful book, because the distinction between criminal procedure and civil procedure was not very pronounced in the early days of what we now call the Romano-Canonical procedure. The ancestor, Ellen, also mentioned that procedure, and I think our Italian colleague also mentioned in his speech, that procedure that lays at the basis of modern continental procedure, the Romano-Canonical procedure. I've written down here that the law of evidence was and is first and foremost about guarantees that in the end the judgment will be based, and I'm writing here, on the truth. And I'm a bit hesitant to say that after our discussions right now. Based on the truth, whatever the truth may be in any given legal system and in any given period of time. And you can really see that these ideas change over time by looking at some history. For example, the ordeals and the other Germanic forms of proof as they existed before and even after the rise of our Romano-Canonical procedure in the late 11th century. Were based on the belief that God's direct intervention in litigation would guarantee the truth. And so basically it was a method, a procedural device, and the end result, due to the intervention of God, would be, according to we the evil man, the truth. So it's not so much the way the evidence was established, but it was this procedure, for example, trial by battle, and the winner then would, due to the intervention of God, have proven his or her, his, usually his case. Medieval men, however, quickly discovered that ordeals were an ideal instrument to fabricate the truth, and it was also a means of allowing the most cunning and wealthy litigants to win their case. And therefore, the developed Roman canonical procedure, and that procedure came into being from the 11th century onwards, addressed the issue in a different manner. First of all, it defined the means of proof that would be acceptable in litigation. In many historical and also in modern legal systems, we still encounter the so-called numerous clauses of means of proof. So the code, the law, telling beforehand what would be acceptable means of proof. Well, the Roman canonical procedure had a list, and anything outside that list could presumably not be used. And in addition, it accorded to the various types of proof a certain weight. And we all know an example of it. For example, the idea that two witnesses provide full proof is a remnant from this old system in which proving was, to a large extent, mainly calculating if you had enough means of proof that had the right value. Well, such rules do not result in a system in which proving is really only a mathematical exercise, because, for example, the two-witness rule means that the judge has to establish that there are two reliable witnesses. And so the judge still has to do something with the proof that is available. But if he established that there were two reliable witnesses, there was a duty to consider a certain fact proven. Now, the same is true for other types of proof. For example, we still have remnants of it in our modern system. For example, the rule that a certain claim can only be proven by way of the existence of a certain document. That's also that dates from that time. All kinds of rules that limit your capability of proving. And obviously the idea is that the judge cannot be trusted, that's in the end, we human beings cannot be trusted, so there need to be objective rules in the area of proof, in the area of evidence. Now, in modern system, of course, the situation is very different. Most modern systems have discarded these old proof rules altogether. Either by, for example, saying that the numerous clauses should not be observed anymore. The numerous clauses, the limited list of means of proof, has removed from the statute book. And if that has not been done, very often the means of proof document has been interpreted in a very wide manner, so that anything that doesn't fit in the list can be classified as a document. And the judge in modern system obviously is given ample freedom in deciding whether or not certain facts have been proven. Have we been referring to the conviction intime from the French Revolution? That's very often still the standard in modern continental systems. And I think that these developments are the result of the realization that rules on how the judge should come to the conclusion that facts have been proven are very hard to give in advance. It's very difficult to give rules on how the judge should come to the conclusion that facts have been proven in a case. Very often that can only be done afterwards. And that does not mean that the reasoning of the judge in the judgment dealing with proof cannot be tested afterwards, for example by the appellate court. But what you very often see is that the appellate court only tests this in a very loose manner. In the Netherlands, for example, the Cassation Court sometimes comes to the conclusion that no reasonable judge could have considered a certain fact proven based on the reasoning provided. But that's a test that is not very, very, very strict. And so a lot of freedom is left to the judge. So the first instance judge, the trial judge, the Americans would say, is very autonomous in reaching his or her decision. Well, it's, I think, after this conference clear that the rules on proof in any given legal system reflect the beliefs as regards the concept of truth in that system, and the way in which we humans are able to uncover that truth. And of course, truth, I'm not going to define truth, because that's a very, also a concept that is very much dependent on time and on the legal system. Also, the rules on proof, I think, reflect the wider procedural context in which they are used. You cannot really discuss proof rules separate from the legal system. I'm struggling with that every month, because we have this EU project in Ukraine, and there we are competing with US aid, because the Americans also are trying to sell their procedural system to the Ukrainians. And very often they are very much impressed by the American ideas, and they then copy rules that, well, we already predicted that are not going to function in their legal system. They're so foreign to what they're doing. They look appealing, and the Americans sell them these ideas without context, and the result is very often disastrous. But the sad thing is that, well, anywhere in the world, American ideas are usually more popular than continental ideas, so we have difficulties in convincing these people, don't do it, but very often, luckily, we succeed. So proof rules are very much linked to the system in which they function. So in my talk, I will tell you something about what we do in the Netherlands. Ellen has already told you a lot about what we've done in this European project, the project of the European Law Institute. But I think the Dutch example is interesting, maybe not because it's an example of best practices all the time, but it's an example of a system that works quite efficiently. And maybe we can criticize or what's happening in the Netherlands, but it's just showing you how what I think is a rather modern system of proof functions within a Dutch procedural context. And it may be an example of how we could do things in Europe. Maybe not, but that's something that we could discuss after this presentation. We've moved a long way in the Netherlands, because our original system comes from France. Napoleon introduced, he annexed the Netherlands to France, and as a result of that we got the French rules on procedure, also the proof rules. And that was a relatively old-fashioned system. The rules were scattered over various codes. Part of it could be found in the civil code, the so-called substantive proof rules that told you, well, what, for example, the requirements a document needed to meet, or what an expert needed to do. And then there were the procedural proof rules that could be found in the Code of Civil Procedure. Since 1988, everything has been brought together, because that's more handy, in the Code of Civil Procedure. And these rules function in a system which I feel is beneficial for efficiency, and maybe to a certain extent also beneficial for finding the truth. I'm not really think that it's finding the truth in the sense of, well, this, how should I, I'm a little bit worried at this moment. We've discussed truth so much, and it's a little bit different from what I'd written down before, but not so much in the sense of the everyday truth, but I really think that in the end, what the system does, it provides us with the truth that is relevant in litigation. I was going to call it the legal truth, but I'll not do that anymore. But I strongly feel that the set of facts that we bring together in a civil lawsuit can be distinguished from the everyday. It's different, but we'll go to that into that matter later on. How does the procedure look like? We used to have a procedure in the 19th century. A famous Dutch author on civil procedure said, well, we have a procedure that adheres to the principle of the passivity of the judge. The judge is passive. Before that time, nobody had heard about that principle, but the 19th century was a time in which one wanted to look at procedure from a principled perspective. So they were looking for principles, and the idea was the judge should be passive. And, well, that was in line with the ideas of the time, because it was thought that, well, parties can shape their life by making contracts, for example. If they have a problem with that contract, if they start to litigate about it, why should the judge or the state intervene in their private relationship? So if you litigate about a matter of private law, you should be left on your own. The judge should be a little bit like a passive umpire, making sure that the rules of the game are observed, but that's about it. Now, that has changed dramatically, because since 2002, the Dutch judge has many powers, which we would now define as case management powers. For example, the Dutch judge has to guard against undue delay. He has to take measures, and by the way, I'm saying he, but of course that also includes she, but for reason, it's easier to say only he. I won't say he and she all the time, because then it becomes a bit tedious. Maybe I should say she. She can take the necessary measures to prevent undue delay. The Dutch judge also makes sure that the proceedings unfold in an orderly manner. He may deny further postponements of the action. He may deny further submissions of statements of case. And the judge also has extended powers as regards the factual basis of the case and evidence. And for example, the judge may order the parties, whenever necessary during the proceedings, to provide information, either orally or by way of documents. And the judge may even ex officio investigate the facts of the case by way of a court hearing, in which the parties themselves have to make an appearance. So the judge may order the parties to come before him, and then he may question them. He may also order the parties to provide proof by way of witnesses, for example. He may order that witnesses should be introduced, although the judge may not nominate the witnesses himself, but he may order witness evidence is needed. He may investigate the truth of the contested facts by way of a local inspection. By the way, that local inspection we call descente, the very Dutch word, local inspection, descente sur les lieux, which is basically the judge, well, we know what it is, going to a certain place in order to observe how the situation is. And the judge may also, at his own initiative, order an expert report to be made. And this approach, I think, is a rather modern approach. Maybe for an English lawyer it's going too far, because I think that English case management powers mainly concern procedural aspects, but here you see that the judge goes into the content of the case itself. The judge is very active in the area of the collection of evidence. What has further happened is that a civil action in the Netherlands has changed very much. We used to have what the Japanese call the Meirin procedure, but in order to understand that, you need to know the climate in Japan in May. Does anyone know how the climate looks like in Japan in May? Well, it rains at short intervals. So rain, and then it's dry again, and then the sun starts to shine, rain again, and whatever. That's the old-fashioned approach to litigation. You would have a hearing for submitting your statement of defense, and then the judge would postpone the hearing for the next procedural step. No concentration. And of course, that is not very beneficial for efficiency, for a quick decision of the case, because these postponements were also very convenient for judges who were busy. They had an interest in postponing, because that meant your table was clean and you could do something else. Since 2002, we have a different model, aiming at concentration, and it looks like this. You summon your opponent, and in the summons you already have to provide your statement of claim. Then the defendant is given some time to submit her statement of defense, and then there must be an oral hearing in court. In all cases, unless it's really superfluous, the judge must order the parties and their lawyers to a hearing in court. And the interesting thing about that hearing in court is that at that moment, the judge, in cooperation with the parties, will decide how the rest of the procedure will look like. We don't have procedural tracks, but we have a hearing in which the judge, together with the parties, determines what is needed in the next stages of litigation. The judge may come to the conclusion that nothing else is needed, that the case can be decided. The parties sometimes don't know that. And therefore the parties have an interest in submitting all the relevant facts and their evidence in a very early stage, because the case may be over after this first hearing. But if parties and the judge come to the conclusion that it's not over, that it's a more complicated case, they get together and then they decide about how the case will unfold in court. They discuss what is needed, and the judge tries to reach an agreement with the parties. And that means that each case, in a way, is tailor-made. The procedure is the result of this discussion of the judge and the parties. Very often the case settles, by the way, in this stage already, because Dutch judges will also actively try to settle the case. A Dutch judge may say, well, you have a problem, and obviously I can provide you with a judgment in this particular case. But let's imagine it's a family matter, it's a divorce case. Then the judge will say, of course I can decide your case, but remember you have children, and your relationship is not terminated with me giving a judgment, giving a divorce. Your relationship will continue. So wouldn't it be an idea if you go outside my courtroom for a while and discuss whether you can come to some kind of settlement? Well, that is done, especially in family cases, on a regular basis, and very often then the case settles, especially if the judge is a bit, more experienced. Parties may be willing to do that, because they do realize then suddenly that litigation might not be the best approach to matters. Of course, this may not work in commercial cases, but it works in these family cases. So an early oral hearing aimed at settlement, aimed at, if a settlement is not possible, maybe a decision, and if a decision is not possible, a discussion on how the case will unfold in court. During the hearing, parties may be ordered to submit supplementary documents, and they may also be ordered to provide the relevant evidence, as I already stated. So I would say a rather informal way of litigating. It's informal, but at the same time, within Dutch conditions, it seems to work. I'm not sure if this would work in a very formalistic environment. I'm not sure, for example, whether this would work in Ukraine, where parties have a very different approach to matters. But within the context of Dutch society, it seems to work. Now something about more specific about evidence law in the Netherlands. So this is the context. This is the context in which the law of evidence has to function. First of all, of course, what needs to be proven in a civil lawsuit? Of course, not all of the facts alleged by a party. Undisputed facts, of course, don't need proof. And no proof is needed either for facts that are expressly recognized by the opponent party. Notorious facts don't need proof, and general empirical rules of experience, they need not to be proven either. And the same is true for positive law. Jus curia novit applies, the judge knows the law, which basically means that the judge can even decide that the legal basis that the parties have provided for their claim should not be followed. If I bring a claim in tort and the judge comes to the conclusion that it's a contractual claim, he or she will apply the rules on contract. The court, and I think that's a general continental idea, is in charge of applying the law. Then the burden of proof. Obviously, the parties are in charge of proving contested facts. According to the burden of proof, that is established by the court. So the court decides in an early phase who has to prove what. And the main doctrine on the burden of proof in Dutch civil litigation can be found in the Code of Civil Procedure. And it says, roughly translated, the party who invokes the legal consequences of the facts or rights posed by him has the burden of proof of these facts or rights, unless a specific legal rule or the requirements of equity or fairness require a different distribution of the burden of proof. And this, of course, allows the judge in certain cases, maybe medical malpractice cases, to shift the burden of proof, to put the burden of proof, for example, on the side of the doctor, who then has to prove that he did not do anything wrong, even though the patient left the operation room handicapped or whatever. A party who has the burden of proof and who does not provide the required evidence will suffer the detrimental consequences of not having proven the facts that are relevant for his case, since the burden of proof produces what is called in Dutch the evidentiary risk. If you have the burden of proof, of course, you cannot be forced to prove, but the consequences of not proving are yours. That's the evidentiary risk. But of course, there is no plicht. Ellen referred to that that concept. There is no duty to prove. You cannot be forced to prove. But you know, if you don't do, you will lose your case. So the decision of the judge on the burden of proof in the early stages is very important. If you are allotted the burden of proof, that's quite a burden, I would say. Sometimes you can arrange matters in a different way, and that is due to so-called, I translate it into English, evidentiary agreements on evidence, on the distribution of the burden of proof. Because under certain circumstances, the parties may conclude such an agreement in which they may deviate from the applicable rules of evidence pending litigation, or they may exclude their application in view of future litigation. So even before a case is brought, you may vary the rules of proof at your convenience if you come to an agreement with your opponent. This is different in certain situations. For example, the law says that a marriage can only be proven by a marriage certificate. You cannot vary that one, but for the rest, you're very free in making agreements with your opponent. So here we have the party having the burden of proof, who now has to offer proof of the facts on which the claim or his defense is based. And obviously, quite often that proof can be found in documentary evidence, documents. Judges in the Netherlands, like in many other countries, like documents. You should remember that in some countries, other types of proof have very often disappeared. In France, for example, judges don't like witnesses. They don't want witnesses. Documents is what they want. And therefore, in a French courtroom, you very rarely see witnesses. Witnesses take a lot of time. It's time-consuming, and judges are busy, so they try to avoid them. So proof is being offered based on the distribution of the burden of proof. When does proof have to be submitted? We don't have the even evidentiary maxim anymore, so there is not this rule like they had in the 19th century Germany. Ellen referred to it, in which you had to provide everything at a very early stage, and if you would do it later, you would be precluded from offering that proof. We don't have that rule, but the way procedure is framed in the Netherlands nevertheless makes that you have an interest in being very early in providing all the necessary information, because you know, well, we have an early oral hearing, and the judge may decide the case, may decide that the case is ready for a decision after this early oral hearing, so we better provide all the relevant information, because after that decision, of course, no further proof is allowed. Most decisions on proof are made by way of interlocutory judgments. So very often when a judge decides on proof, there is a ruling, an interlocutory ruling of the court. So by looking at the case file, you get a clear view on what has really happened in the case. The judge is in charge of the collection of evidence. Evidence can only be taken by the judge, a judge commissioner or a panel of judges, And there are no specific conditions for taking evidence before such a judge commissioner. Dutch law is not very good as regards the principle of immediacy. And when a case is decided by a panel of judges, witnesses, for example, will not be heard by the whole panel. It will be a judge commissioner who hears the witnesses. The rule now is that this judge should be part, a member of the panel, but even that is sometimes not needed. And the witness evidence that is being given is not being recorded by way of a tape recording or whatsoever. It's not being written down verbatim by a clerk. But what happens is the judge listens, and then the judge summarizes what he has heard. And obviously he summarizes, or she summarizes, in a legal manner, omitting all those matters that he or she thinks are irrelevant. That way of doing business is criticized, because obviously you may lose important information. At the same time, it's very efficient, because later, when the case has to be decided, the judge doesn't have to go through all kinds of long, lengthy recordings. He doesn't have to look very lengthy documents, but you have a short summary in which, presumably, all the relevant matters are being discussed. Obviously, parties always have the right to be present during proof proceedings. I think that is something that is not new. And actually, there are no limitations as regards the means of proof. I already mentioned this old numerous clauses of means of proof is not married anymore. There are a few exceptions. The marriage, proving a marriage can only be done by an official record. But for the rest, you are free in providing proof in any way you want. There is also no mandatory sequence as regards the presentation of proof. You may follow your own insights, but obviously it's appreciated when you're early in the case, as I mentioned earlier on. Is there any standard against which proof is being evaluated by the judge? Actually, there's not. It's a modern version of the intimate conviction of the judge. And basically, the judge, in his reasoning, in the judgments, has to provide a story that is acceptable to the parties, and also, if the case is being appealed of, is acceptable to the appellate court and later the court of cassation. Reasoning is considered to be a legal matter, so the court of cassation can take notice of the way the judge deals with the proof, why the judge thinks that the case has been proven. And the best definition of the principle in Dutch is the free assessment of evidence, which I think in the end is this intimate conviction standard. Well, that is, I think, what I should say about the procedure, and we should now maybe have a look at some specific types of evidence, but maybe not before I've mentioned one issue that is hotly debated in Europe, and that is illegal evidence. I think we have not discussed illegal evidence until now, or was it mentioned by some of you in your presentation? Mm-hmm. Evidence, for example, that is obtained in an illegal manner. In the Netherlands, the concept of illegal evidence or illegally obtained evidence is of very limited relevance in civil litigation. In 1988, when they were recodifying the law on evidence, it was decided that this should not be codified. No rules as regards illegally obtained evidence should be in the code, because it was the idea this should be left to case law. In this legal literature, we read that a duty to litigate in a fair manner and not with the help of information that has been obtained illegally has to be weighed, so you should balance it, against the duty of truth of the parties in a civil lawsuit and against the interest of finding the truth in civil litigation in general. And so illegally obtained evidence is not excluded automatically, it should be balanced against other other interests. And in the literature, in the legal literature, but not in case law, there seems to be consensus about the fact that illegally obtained evidence may result in the exclusion of this material in civil litigation. But there is no agreement about the question when illegally obtained evidence may be excluded. And when you look at case law, it actually rarely happens that evidence is considered to be illegally obtained. I can give a few examples of cases. For example, there was a case about a recording of a telephone call, a business call, and that recording had been made without notifying the other party. And the court held that this could not be qualified as illegally obtained. Camera observations of the house of someone entitled to welfare, for example, so you have these civil servants who try to find out if you get money that you don't deserve. And they place a camera in front of your house, for example, to see whether you share the house with someone else, with your lover or whatever. Videos are considered okay in a civil lawsuit, so they are not, they do not result in an exclusion of the evidence. And actually, all cases I looked at, in the end, the conclusion was, well, either it's not illegally obtained, and if it is considered to be illegally obtained, it can still be used in litigation. I think Dutch judges favor a different approach to these matters. They're not going to exclude this evidence, but obviously the party that uses that evidence may face litigation afterwards in which damages are being claimed. Because obviously there is sometimes something wrong with this. But in the pending lawsuit, this evidence will be, most of the time, will be used by the court. Because apparently it is found that the duty of truth is so important that this evidence should be taken into account. Types of evidence in the Netherlands. Obviously this is a bit of a an exercise which is maybe not even needed, because we don't have a numerous clauses anymore. You can provide evidence by all means. Nevertheless, the code contains a list of types of evidence. And as regards these types of evidence, more information is provided. And I think that's useful, because obviously sometimes you want to regulate the use of certain types of evidence in more detail. I'm not sure if the list of types of evidence in the Dutch code is a modern list, because what I would say is, well, what you have to do is, when you're listing these means of evidence, you should actually target the ones that are problematic. Maybe there should be rules on electronic documents. And for judges, I think it's often very difficult to see how these documents can be falsified. Other types of evidence. It is very easy, I guess, for a judge to establish that a signature has been falsified. But if you're talking about electronic signatures, of course, the situation is different. So I would expect, in a modern code, a list of types of evidence that pose problems, but actually in the existing code that is not the case, because we find the usual list of types of means of proof. First of all, there is documentary evidence listed. Documents are not defined by the code. That's actually something that is surprising. But in literature, what is being said is, well, documents are entities that are capable of carrying legible characters that express an idea when considered in relation to each other. That's a long definition. But it means that not only paper documents can be qualified as documents, but also electronic documents, because obviously also electronic documents carry legible characters that express an idea when considered in relation to each other. Video and audio recordings, on the other hand, do not meet this requirement, and therefore we have to decide that video and audio recordings are not regulated by the code. And some jurisdictions, we equal them to documents, But that's not the case in the Netherlands. Not problematic, because we don't have a numerous clauses, a closed list of means of proof. As a general rule, the parties are free to submit documentary evidence in any states of the proceedings, but as we remember, they have an interest in submitting those documents early. And that actually happens in cases. Parties are not late in submitting documentary evidence. Electronic documents, that is, I think, something that is not special to the Netherlands. Maybe now I should say something about witnesses. The judge in the Netherlands may not nominate witnesses. The judge cannot say, well, Mr. X or Mrs. Y should be heard as a witness. But what the judge may do is the judge may order the hearing of witnesses in general. The judge may indicate witnesses should be questioned in court, and then it's up to the party who has the burden of proof to provide the necessary witnesses. If he or she doesn't do that, because there is this evidentiary risk, he or she will most likely not win his or her case. Witnesses are called to court by the interested party, so by the party who has the burden of proof. And when this happens, that party needs to indicate to the witnesses the facts as regards which proof has been ordered by the court, and the consequences for the witness if he or she fails to appear. You are required to appear in court. There is a duty to appear in court when you are ordered to appear as a witness, and not appearing is a criminal offence and may result in all kinds of detrimental consequences. So you have a duty to make an appearance in court. The court, of course, fixes a date and time for the hearing of witnesses, and outside of the hearing, no witnesses can be heard. Both parties have the right to be present in court when witnesses are being questioned. Witnesses are not questioned by the parties. It is the judge who is in charge. And that also means, I think, that there is not this risk that witnesses become intimidated. We heard yesterday that maybe in sexual abuse cases, you have to be very careful because the victim or the alleged victim may be intimidated when she is cross-examined by the defendant counsel. That will not happen in the Dutch court because it is the judge who questions the witness. In some cases, at the end of the questioning, the judge may allow the lawyers of the parties to ask some additional questions. But that is very often considered to be, telling the judge you have not done your work well. So lawyers are very hesitant in asking additional questions because it may convey the message, well, judge, your work was not as good as it should be. Anyone may be a witness in a Dutch court, although persons who cannot understand the significance of an oath or a promise don't provide that oath or a promise. So if they commit perjury, these young persons, usually young persons, cannot be punished. But obviously, again, that's not a problem, because in the end it's the judge who evaluates the force of the proof that has been provided. So you don't need all kinds of specific rules. We don't have to exclude these witnesses from testifying because the judge will know, oh, this is a young person, no oath or no promise, so maybe I should evaluate that evidence in a certain way. That's, by the way, also what I like very much about a system without a jury. In a jury system, you need all kinds of rules to make sure that a jury doesn't take into consideration information that is problematic. I feel that trained judges, ideally, don't have that problem. They know the pitfalls of certain types of evidence and certain types of situations. In the Dutch system, parties can also serve as witnesses. You can be a party witness. The only thing you cannot do is provide evidence for your, in favor of your own case. But as a party, you may be questioned as a witness in court. And again, this leniency is most likely the result of the fact that the judge evaluates the evidence and he or she knows, well, this information has been provided by a party, so maybe we should evaluate that evidence in a different manner than the evidence given by a witness who doesn't have an interest in the case at hand. Well, what else shall I say? I have something here about privilege, but I think that is not so so special. Once again, I could say that we have this problem with immediacy, but that's probably an issue that is a problem in many of the civil law countries, because our original procedure is based or is aimed at building a dossier. We want to build a written file of the case. And in such a file, of course, you want a document explaining what a witness has told. Hearing witnesses in open court, examination in chief and cross-examination is not something that is favored by a procedure that is based on building a dossier. That's now being questioned. Some people say, well, if we should change the Dutch approach to matters, we should start making recordings of live testimony of witnesses. But I think that for reasons of efficiency, we're still a bit hesitant about doing that. I know that Professor Zelac is very much in favor of recording live testimony, and he says, well, it's nonsense to make this summary that is dictated by the judge and the party that has to say, well, this summary is okay. It's much better to have a recording. But many people in the Netherlands feel that having recordings doesn't solve matters. It makes the litigation much more complicated. Because if you want to go back to your recording, well, you have to look at the tape. And finding the right part of the tape is maybe time-consuming. So maybe here we are trying to weigh efficiency against finding the truth. And maybe here then the decision is that efficiency is more important. But it is an issue. Video recordings are still not made very often in Dutch courts. Video conferencing is being done, but it's also considered to be a bit problematic, because when you hear a witness through a video link, you miss a lot. It's very easy to lie in the comfort of your own study. On paper it's even more easy to lie. But when you're in a courtroom, of course, that's much more difficult. And therefore, hearing witnesses through video links, well, it is becoming more common, but it's according to some maybe old-fashioned judges, it's still thought to be problematic. We have experts as well, and experts, and that may be good news for you. Experts are listed as means of evidence in the Dutch code, but I personally feel that they don't provide evidence, that it's something else. But I think we discussed that in length yesterday. Experts' reports are listed under the heading of evidence, but at the same time you read that they should provide neutral information. They don't testify on the facts of the case, but they testify on something else. Can a bridge constructed in this way carry 5 tons a truck of 5 tons? I don't know whether trucks are that heavy, or maybe they are more heavy. But anyway, some neutral questions, these are being answered by experts. What is the chance that you get sick when you work with asbestos? That's, of course, not a fact that is part of the case, it's a more general fact. And in that sense, I would say expert opinions are not evidence. What they are is difficult to say, but I feel it's something else. It should not be treated as evidence, it should be treated in a different way. But we may discuss that as well. Experts are being, how does expert evidence work? The judge qualifies the question or phrases the questions that need to be answered. Then he asks the parties whether they agree or not, and if they agree, then the expert drafts his report, and usually that is a written report. And if the parties disagree with the outcome of the expertise, they may provide their own expertise if they wish. So in that sense, it looks a little bit like evidence, but I feel that still it's slightly different. And the last means of evidence that is mentioned in the code is the local inspection, the descente sur les lieux, in which the judge gathers information by looking at, for example, a building site and making a report of what he or she sees there. You may expect also a presumption as a means of evidence, but presumptions nowadays are not considered to be evidence anymore. We tend to say that presumptions are just a way of reasoning. It's a way of reasoning. A presumption, of course, is based one, you observe one fact, and from that fact, you, by way of reasoning, you try to deduct something else. The most famous one, I like that one, it's in, I collect old antiquarian books on procedure, and one of the books says, a young man and a young woman are found nude in bed together, the law presumes evil. So we see the fact, they are in bed together, no clothes, and then we presume that they've done something that is not, they're not married, by the way, that they've done something that is not allowed. So it's deducting information, but it's not actually proving something. And therefore, presumptions, although they sometimes occur in particular legislation, are not part of the Code of Civil Procedure anymore. I see that I've been talking about for more than 50 minutes, so maybe I should come to a conclusion. Well, what to say? I hope you're going to be very critical. I feel that this is an approach to matters. The Dutch approach is an approach to matters that is very much aiming at efficiency. It's aiming at deciding cases relatively quickly. Also from the perspective that society at large has an interest in civil cases. The 19th century idea, of course, was it's a private matter between private parties. But we now much more follow the ideas of Franz Klein, saying, well, civil litigation is also about messages. In Ukraine, if you have a debt and you want to go to court, it takes about 10 years, 11 years, I think also in Italy, if I'm not mistaken, to get a final judgment. That's a message. That's not only something that concerns the debtor and the creditor, but that's a message. The message in Italy and in Ukraine is don't pay. You don't have to pay because you have 10 years of time before something might happen. And that's what Franz Klein says is important to realize. The opposite approach is, of course, well, you have to pay your debts. If you get a judgment within a short period of time, other litigants will know, well, we have to pay. If we don't pay, the law will enforce this claim in a very short time frame. It's also about messages about the state of the law, for example. As we all know, as lawyers, we are interested in case law. Case law is generated by individual cases, but it's important. So we are all interested in having decisions on certain matters, and well, hopefully these decisions are being taken within a short time frame. So society at large is interested in a well-working justice system. And then you have to weigh certain interests. Of course, on the one hand side, the interest is quality and justice. But on the other hand side, you have efficiency and these messages, and there should be a trade-off between the two, I think. Also realizing that litigation is paid by society at large, so you cannot have a Rolls-Royce procedure for relatively unimportant cases. You need to come to the right balance, and that is, I think, what has been tried in the Dutch system. And what I can say is that the system is very efficient. That's for sure. You get decisions in a very short time frame. But of course, some may question the quality. Although there is little there are little complaints about that in my own country. At the same time, you should realize that this system only works if the judges have a certain attitude. Ellen said, well, you need judges who want to decide and not judges who want to postpone. Our judges want to decide for various reasons. There is, of course, the professional ethos they really want to achieve. But there is also this system that our courts are financed based on output. And if the output is low in a certain year, the money available for the court goes down, which some English judges thought a horrible system, but it works. So there is this inherent wish to produce judgments. In some other systems, and once again, I'm sorry, I'm active in Ukraine, but I've seen there what happened. There, the attitude is, no, we don't want to decide, because deciding is dangerous. I may hurt my career, because there may be an appeal against me. And also, I have 1,000 cases at my table, so what I want is postpone. Postpone as much as possible, and then I can manage my docket. Obviously, that's a very different situation, and whether the Dutch approach to matters would work in such a system is very, very questionable. So a system that finds its origins in French procedure, but that has evolved tremendously, especially during the 20th and the 21st century. And a system, I think, that can at least serve as a model of efficiency. And obviously, I'm very curious to hear your concerns about this system in the discussion that will hopefully follow. Thank you very much for your attention.